Pergnum Theater people, welcome to a special series of Your Program Is Your Ticket, coming to you from Midtown Manhattan, right in the middle of Broadway. My name is Sean Chandler, and I'll be your host. Your Program Is Your Ticket is a discussion of smaller theater works and the people and organizations that make it happen. As many of you know, Your Program Is Your Ticket is a helpful system where your program is literally your ticket to get into the theater and smaller, more intimate productions. It's these works we like to highlight, and it's our goal on this show to feature as many of these productions as possible while still discussing the biggies. I love theater and see as much as I can wherever I go. During the travels of the production of my husband and my play, At the Flash, I met many wonderful people from all over the world in the theater community, and it is my honor to bring them on as guests to the show. Tonight's show is part two of a special series of interviews for the 2018 Frigid Festival here in New York City. Founded in 2007, Frigid is an open and uncensored theater festival that gives artists an opportunity to let their ingenuity thrive in a venue that values freedom of expression and artistic determination. Now, I recently had the honor of sitting down with a superb, passionate artist within the Frigid Festival to speak with them about their individual shows, their wonderful experience with Frigid Festival, and their overall thoughts on theater itself. My guests on this episode are Ilse Jewell from I Lied to Marianne Williamson, A Totally True Story, Megan Bandelt from What She Found and Jack Spagnola, and Noam Shapiro from Little League. These three shows have wonderfully variant themes, and I just know you're going to find all of the artists to be delightful. Now, quick note, as you listen, you may hear some minor differences in audio. These interviews were recorded at separate times and locations. Not that that takes any of the enjoyment out of the experience of these fabulous artists. Just letting you know in case the sound feels different from one interview to the other. So folks, without further ado, please enjoy interviews with Ilse Jewell from I Lied to Marianne Williamson, A Totally True Story, Megan Bandelt from What She Found, and Jack Spagnola and Noam Shapiro from Little League. Folks, please welcome to the show Ilse Jewell from I Lied to Marianne Williamson, A Totally True Story. Hi, Ilse, and welcome to Your Program Is Your Ticket.
Hi, thank you for having me.
It's great to have you here. I am like super intrigued by the title of your show, and I love that it's a true story because I've read a lot of Marianne Williamson's work myself. So please tell our audience about your show in particular.
Okay. My show is primarily a weaving together of celebrity sightings and a discussion or a theme around death and dying. Basically, what has happened is I started storytelling about a year and a half ago, and I had three rules. And they were no celebrity stories, don't use any disparaging language, and have fun. And so I've decided that I'm going to break the first rule, and I'm really happy that I did. And in breaking that rule and sort of selecting stories from, I don't know, maybe over the last 20 years of my life and linking them together, a very clear narrative emerges, even if we are sort of leaping around in time.
What caused you to generate those three rules?
Basically, I've had a fairly interesting life, and I just felt like I needed some organizing principles. And I also felt like talking about celebrities, since I've been in New York City for 27 years, and you sort of bump into them or see them or interact with them.
Sure.
You know, it to a varying degree for different people, that it just seemed like the easiest way would be to get up and just be like, oh, and then there was a time so-and-so did or didn't do something, or it was a failed or successful interaction or something like that. And so I just thought, to start with, I'm going to strip that away. And it was good because it challenged me to then have to go look for grittier stuff, but to sort of respect the people in the stories. Like some of the early stories I told were about when I was a teenager, and so kind of honoring those kids that I did some like kind of sketchy stuff with, but to make it a little adventurous. I always like for my stories to have a little adventure, a little comedy. I mean, basically everyone survives all of my stories. I'm obviously here, so I've survived my stories. And so that's basically how the show sort of came into being.
So you felt like the idea of celebrity sightings was just kind of played out, and maybe not necessarily, I'm just guessing here, wasn't really as connected to real life.
Well, I don't want to. No, I actually think it's very much a part of if you're in Manhattan, and I've been in Manhattan for 23 years, living here and working here.
Right.
I don't think there's a person who would have been here for 2.5 decades that wouldn't have celebrity stories. And I guess just for me, I just thought, Ilse, you're going to strip that out right now. And I said, fine, I'll strip it out, and then I'll have to go poke around for other things.
Okay.
So, and again, it's nothing negative. People can get up and tell celebrity stories. Great, that's their choice. I just knew that for myself, I didn't want to do that.
Well, it's very definitely a it's a disconnection from not necessarily reality, because celebrities have their own reality.
Correct.
But it's a disconnection from most of the people.
Right.
You know, there's...
And also, it's always you're going to have, oh, my God, there's whomever.
Right.
And I didn't want to bring, like, oh, my God, there's whomever, because then that's the meat of the story. I wanted to become a good storyteller. If I just told you I got a 5-minute story, let's pretend, because most open mics in the city are 5 minutes. I got my 5 minutes. Maybe I do a fantastic job of not getting to work on time that morning in 5 minutes. To me, I needed to be challenged.
Mm-hmm.
And there's adventure. And there's the New York City subway. I mean, the beautiful thing about New York City is it can be featured in a story in brilliant ways. Food, transportation, things go well, things go wrong.
Most of the
time they kind of go wrong.
Sure.
Architecture, sure. You know, crazy people, super beautiful people. I mean, it's such an amazing place to live. I'm always like embarrassed at how much is going on out here. New York City is unbelievable in terms of, I get why you would call it one of the greatest cities of the world. Like, we've got plenty of problems, but it's also just a fantastically amazing place to just, you walk down the street, you walk through a park. Sometimes I can just pretend that I have a tracking shot of me just like walking into a grocery store, and there's like some soundtrack in my mind playing along to it. I'm like, that could be a scene in a movie. Why not?
You know, it's interesting that you say that, because my husband and I, we both were born and raised and lived in Los Angeles for up until about 3 years ago when we moved to New York. And there isn't a time when I don't walk outside and go, oh my God, I live in New York City. and I told him at one point, you know, we were having dinner or something out on a patio, and I said, you know, everywhere you look is a camera shot.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
And it's also always changing.
True, very
Things
true.
Things are always shifting. And it's amazing that so much can be in movement, and yet it's still the city.
Wow. So do you do primarily storytelling
In the last year and a half, I've been storytelling live. I had been writing for a long time, but that was just sort of stories and I don't know, I wrote for myself primarily.
Wow. Now, I understand that this marks your off-Broadway debut.
Yeah.
How does that feel?
Feels awesome.
Does it?
Yeah. Want me to tell you about it?
Of course, yes.
So basically, you know, Frigid is a thing that's mostly by chance. I guess there's some group of people that at midnight they all hit submit, submit, submit. They were submitted, and then there was another 15 people that just had their names pulled out of a hat.
Sure.
I was the first person on the waiting list. I get an email, you're the first person on the waiting list. Awesome. A week later, I get, there's a spit. The first spot is up, open. Do you want it? I'm like, yep, I want it. But then the most amazing thing happened, which is I was like, I don't have a 45-minute show. I have some 5-minute stories, but I don't want to tell those stories. So I had to start to craft a solo show, my very first solo show. And the most amazing thing happened, which is that it filled my mind. And I've never felt so entirely happily consumed by something. Because now, if I ever have a moment of downtime, I don't have to worry. I need to think about my show, because even tonight, on this very night, I'll be performing next Wednesday. I don't even have it done. I mean, and in a weird way, it'll never be done, because I'm coming out of storytelling like the other people that are coming from scripted drama or scripted whatever. I'm loosely scripted, but based on the way an audience is acting in a particular night, how I'm feeling on a particular night, how the first performance to the third performance to the fifth performance, I don't know what that'll be. I'm actually kind of excited to see what happens. I know I'm going to be into it. I know getting up to it, I'll be like, oh, nerves. But then once, boom, I get on, like something falls into place for me, and then I start telling, and then I'm happy. The audience in general, up until I've told 5-minute, 10-minute, 15-minute stories, we've had fun. People seem happy. So I had to break it down into, instead of 45 minutes, I thought of it as, well, let's look at it as like maybe 7 5-minute stories. And so I sort of do the first three stories are sort of celebrity-based, kind of light. I serve as my own kind of warm-up act. Then, boom, we get into sort of the heart of the story, and then we're flowing for hopefully the next 25, 30 minutes, and then it'll be, thank you all, good night, come and, you know, come and see me again someday.
Wow.
My next show.
Now, have you tried out segments of the
story? I actually performed the first 10 minutes here. They have a thing called snapshots, and I think in the past they used to do it all as one thing, but this year they've changed the format at Frigid. And so I performed in the middle of January, and I did the first 10 minutes, and it was a crowd I didn't know anyone in. The first time that ever happened, it was like 11:30 on a school night. I mean, I have a job, right? So I was like, what?
Yeah.
I come in, I did my 10 minutes. Everyone was good. The crowd was good. I was good. I walked off and I was like, wow, I have to change things. And then I had to trash or scrap or get rid of a whole bunch of stuff and restructure and write some new stuff. And it's better.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was based just on
partly the response, but I also knew that the way I had been writing, I wasn't moving the story forward. Oh. And everything I needed to do needed to keep moving the story forward. And that was fine because, you know, it's whatever, you know. I'm not even getting paid, right? I'm doing this because I want to do it. I'm doing it because I like storytelling. I'm doing it because I want to have the experience of doing it. So I don't see that I lose anything. And that was the whole reason why I hit the, you know, submit my name randomly. I'm like, I have nothing to lose. Either they don't call my name and I've lost nothing, or they call my name and I do a show and I still lose nothing. I have only something to gain. Even
absolutely.
You and I sitting here chatting is a gain for me. This is in the win column.
Well, thank you. That's great. I appreciate that.
No, it is, right? Would I have hung out with you before if I hadn't done? No.
Well, I definitely
would. I would be on another path, which would have been an equally valid path. But this is the path that I'm on. We get to hang out for a little bit, and then we're going to do our thing.
Wow. It feels like you're a very introspective individual.
Yeah, for sure.
And
that's why I get a little itchy. Everything's kind of low, kind of get out. And then it'll come out, and then, you know, with practice, I don't know. But the introspection, definitely.
Wow. Now, tell me about lying to Marianne Williamson.
I'm not sure I can. I mean, I guess the title sort of gives it away. I lied to her. I don't want to say too much about it because it's an important point in the storyline.
Uh-huh.
But I will say I like her a lot, and like you've expressed, you've read her stuff.
Yes.
I've never done A Course in Miracles. A couple weeks ago, I went to the church where she does a Tuesday night, and she sort of talks to people, and I have such an amazing amount of respect for her because I believe that she is bringing good to the world. And this doesn't mean that anyone has to agree with her words or how she does it or any of that. And there are plenty of people that could be like, not into her. Great. That's right. A choice. Then don't go hang out with her. I like her. I respect her. Stumbled onto her when I was in a sort of like self-help phase and did lie to her. And I guess you'll have to come to the show to find out why.
I love it. Create suspense. That's great.
Yeah.
Excellent marketing, by the way.
Thank you.
That's terrific. I remember reading her book, A Return to Love.
Yeah, it's a great one.
Back in, when she first released it.
Yeah.
Back in, I want to say it was like 92 or 93.
It was in the mid-90s, I'm pretty sure. Yeah, early to mid-90s. Yeah.
Right, and it was when she was known for working a lot with AIDS patients.
Yep.
And I thought, you know, I'm not a religious individual, but
right.
If I were to ever prescribe any of the symbolism to the Bible, then,
right.
then I felt like she made it all make sense.
Oh, if you sit down with her or if you go and listen to her talk, you will, again, like I said, even if you're not coming from a religious perspective or if you have an anti-religious perspective, if you just sit down and listen to what she says and why she's saying it. In my opinion, she's saying it to help people heal, and she is incredibly intelligent, and she takes extremely complex material and just makes it seem like, oh yeah, why didn't I figure that out? Honestly.
Wow. And now this is all based on A Course in Miracles.
She stems from A Course in Miracles is what her main thing is. But then her books are sort of ancillary to that.
Okay.
But when I saw her, we weren't doing A Course in Miracles per se. And you'll find out more about that in the show, how I come to interact with her.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right. Excellent.
Yeah.
I know that she does write. Her books have different themes.
Oh, yeah.
Other than Course in Miracles, but that was her.
Well, she recently, when I saw her the other night, she was talking about her. She wrote a book about, I think, turning like 50 and how it freaked her out. So she's always probably going to connect her stuff, which makes sense. Her material generation or chronologically evolves with her. So where she's at is what she'll talk to you about. And that's a beautiful thing when someone does it for 20 or 30 years, because whenever you check in with them somewhere along the line, you can either take a book and read the book from 20 years ago, you can read a book from 10 years ago, you can read the recent book. Because when she turns 70, she's probably going to flip out harder than 50. So she got another book in her at least. One more book.
That's a great joke. I hope we put it in the show.
That probably won't go in the show. Right.
Something tells me, well, no, I guess if she flipped out when she turned 50, she might flip out at 70.
Yeah.
Wow. So how are rehearsals going? How are you working this up in rehearsal?
Well, there's no real such thing as rehearsal for me other than I don't sleep well, so in the middle of the night I'm constantly refining, like you mentioned about introspection. I ride the train in the morning, I ride the train to go home. It's a thought thing. I kind of rely on that, and in particular in doing this show, I don't want to rehearse too hard, because when I do 5-minute sets, it's super tight and every word, it really all counts. I'm trying to be a little looser, and again, not that the words won't count, but we're going to share 45 minutes together. It's got to be kind of like a flowy textured, we're kind of happy, we're kind of thinking, we're kind of moving around, why is she saying that, why'd she show me that, what's going on, you know, it's a much different experience. So technically I guess they're going well, even though they don't really exist.
Okay.
I'm covering the material, but I just think it's different. I don't have other people that I have to hit marks with and cues. I just have myself that I need to worry about with how am I going to do things.
Oh, okay, I see.
And I know how I'm going to do things, which is I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to have a couple of things on the set, which is actually here at Under St. Mark's, do my thing, and it will be what it will be. I always, because I'm coming out of storytelling, as long as I tell a great story, I'm good. If I even showed up and for some reason had forgotten everything except my story, I'd be like, folks, forgot all my props, here's my story, and we'd do it. As a storyteller, I need to be able to have you as in my story, caring, wanting to be here listening, or not. Those are my only choices. Whether I flash some stuff around and do other stuff is, for me as a performer right now, I want to give you a great story.
Tell me about your career before this.
I don't know that I had a career before this. I've had a day job for a while now, 20 years in the city, and like I said earlier, I was writing for myself, and then, I don't know, you know, I went to a storytelling event like 2 years ago, and it was bad, and I was like, gosh, that was horrible, and then I waited a little while, and a friend of mine was like, we should go to a storytelling event at Cornelia Street in the basement on Tuesday, and I was like, okay, let's go, and we went, and it was good. But at the very end of the event, Barbara Alaprantis, who's been doing storytelling for a bajillion years and is fantastic, told a really brief story. But man, the way she told this story, I was like, I want to be able to do that. It was because she's, I mean, not to be ageist in a negative way, she's, I think, somewhere in her 70s, sharp as a tack, looks great, and got up and just, you know what I'm saying? Like, grabbed me.
Sure.
And so I thought that was really powerful. I thought it was, like, something to strive for, that I want to be older, have my shit together, and be able to get up in front of a room and have everyone just, like, kind of zip their lip and listen. That's what I will say this for Cornelia Street. It's a beautiful room for storytelling reception. The audience listens. People are there to tell their stories. People are there to listen. People aren't playing around with their phones. People aren't looking at the exit. You're in there. It's a really respectful space. It's a warm space.
That's really important.
It's amazing.
Especially when you're up
and
there
in New York City.
Own. Yeah.
No, for sure.
Oh, yeah. In any big city, it's just on the phones all day.
The phone thing needs to be, people need to chill out on that already.
Well, it sounds to me like, I mean, I know that storytelling is you can get up there and you can talk, but there's a lot more to it that is taken for granted,
right?
I think, by the audience. I mean, you spend a lot of time developing the muscles of being comfortable
on
stage.
Well, then I'll tell you this now. I'm happy to be freaked out anywhere but on stage. When I get on stage, my worrying, my thinking, did the words click? Am I hitting my stride? Am I doing whatever? All that happens in the middle of the night with my insomnia. All that happens on the train in the morning. All that happens on my lunch break. All that happens everywhere if it's going to happen, but not on stage. On stage, I got to do it, and I just do it, and we're done.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now, have you acted in plays or TV?
I started taking acting classes in September. Very, very, very basic class at a Barrow Group. And I'm in, like, the second beginner level, which is, you know, and I mean, literally, all you do is you send them a check and your name. And they're like, come on down. There's no auditioning. I have an awfully long way to go as an actor, I think. But as a storyteller, because I'm myself and I'm telling you, the main thing right now is true stories about yourself. Okay, well, I lived it. Can I make it interesting for you? I don't know. We'll find out. You know I'm going to tell you a story I want to listen to, and maybe you're going to want to hear.
You know what's great is that I can feel your excitement.
Yeah. You know? I like it.
Good.
I come off stage, and it's like I'm alive in a way that I'm not alive anywhere else.
That's great.
It's amazing.
This is a new opportunity for you, yep. And I remember the first time I had an opportunity to put something up on stage. I'm not an actor, but I am a writer.
Right.
Matter of fact, one of my plays has been performed here. I remember thinking to myself, be aware. Yeah. Remember this.
Oh,
remember
yeah.
how it felt. Stay in the moment.
Yep.
Because this is a charmed time for you.
Yep.
And it's so easy to get all freaked
out. Don't want to get ahead of anything.
Yeah, the producing,
be here.
The marketing, and just be aware of it.
Yep.
And I know that I just feel that that's what's going on with you.
Oh, it's amazing.
Yeah, and I'm so glad that you're recognizing that.
Yeah. Oh, I think this is like this to me is it's a beautiful confluence in the universe. That I'll get to be on this stage, and I don't know who will be in the audience. I'm hoping at least, you know, like I said earlier, 3 or 5 people, whatever. I think it holds 40 people. Hello, 40 people.
It does.
So, you know. But I also, even though this is not a stated rule, if there were 5 people or 50 people, and I've competed at Moths and other story slams, I need to be the same person. I want to just be me telling the best story I can tell in that moment in time. And it doesn't matter who it is.
Wow. You know, that reminds me, I've interviewed both, the New York Neo-Futurists and also the Neo-Futurists who were.
And funny, that's the
Chicago
podcast I listened to.
Oh, did you? Yeah. I did Chicago,
yeah.
I think it was like a couple weeks ago when I was in Chicago with my musical.
Yeah.
And then, but the New York team in December as well. And that's like, that's their number one rule. We are always ourselves.
Yeah.
And everything comes from our lives and from the personal. And
technically, really good actors are doing the same thing. You need to come from being a human being.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, you can come from wherever, but the best probably way you will evoke whatever you're trying to evoke is because you came out of your body into your role, and then you just, you know, you deliver whatever display, bring the thing.
I agree, and I think even in writing as well.
Oh, yeah.
Most human stories are, I mean, the show that I'm writing, it's about the election, and we go the horrible election.
Yeah.
The election, that horrible election in 2000.
I think you mean the most recent one, because
right,
I think they're going to do more than the one. But yeah.
But we have an opening number, and then we have numbers at both different conventions, and then we narrow it down to a mother singing about having to tell her kids who won the very next day.
Right.
And I'm only bringing I know this shouldn't be about me. I'm so sorry. You're
okay.
So interesting that I'm spilling my heart out to you. But I don't have that kind of point of view. I don't.
Right.
So I asked my sister, who has 2 kids, and she lives in Alabama, and she lives like the bottom of the United States.
Right.
I asked her to write an essay for me about what it was like. And
so you can cut from see her point of view.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that is the number one mentioned song that everyone loves.
Oh,
and I think
because
it comes from a human point of view.
Right.
There's that connection.
And even if we have everyone who put him in office disagreeing, it doesn't matter. That person at that moment in your show singing that song, that is a legitimate experience.
Sure.
So it counts for that.
Absolutely.
And it doesn't have to count for anything else. Once I leave here, put on my jacket, go do whatever. That's the other thing I love about this city, which I don't know if you like or not, but the ability to be anonymous. And that's the other thing, if we want to go back to talking about the celebrities, is like, I feel like New York is the kind of place where you're not supposed to be, oh my God! You're just supposed to be like, oh, that's cool.
very laissez-faire about the whole thing. Yeah.
And I will tell one just brief story. So I had a vendor who took me out to lunch, and we're in this really nice restaurant on the Upper West Side, and Danny DeVito is having lunch with us. And Danny DeVito's, in my opinion, an awesome person to be sitting a few tables away from lunch. And the guy with me is like, oh my God, that's so cool, I'm going to go take photos. And I said to my friend, very gently and under my breath, I was like, if you approach Danny DeVito, I will never have lunch with you ever again. And my friend was just like, oh, okay. Because Danny DeVito, maybe Danny DeVito, but he's also a person that just wants to eat lunch unmolested.
True, yeah, right? Absolutely.
And if he does want to have people chase after him, that's great. But it wasn't going to be me and my friend two tables away having our lunch. We were all going to be civilized in this nice restaurant and have lunch. So I had lunch with Danny DeVito.
That's great.
Right?
I could talk to you forever. I thought of another story in my head of something I wanted to talk about, but we are
We're running out of time.
We are running out of time, unfortunately. Okay. So please give the audience your social media information for your show.
Okay. If you want to know anything about me, you can go to ilsajewell.com, and I believe Facebook, I wouldn't know the address, but if you look up I Lied to Marianne Williamson, there's some stuff there, and as I get into doing the performing and I get into a little bit more stuff, I'll be adding more content. So it's a little bare bones now. It'll get it'll have a little spike of information, and then it'll end, and that'll be that.
Very, very cool.
Thank you.
Well, everybody, come see the show.
Please do.
For sure.
There are empty seats. I can see them.
We want more than 3 to 5 people in this theater.
Yes, so. Under St. Mark's.
And just enjoy yourself.
Have
a great time.
Thank you.
I can feel your energy, and it's so refreshing. It's so cool.
Cool. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. So thank you for being with us, Ilse Jewell from I Lied to Marianne Williamson, a totally true story. And you'll have to come see the show to find out why. Okay. Thank you. You're great.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Folks, please welcome to the show Megan Bandel from What She Found. Hi, Megan, and welcome to your program. Is your ticket?
Thank you, Sean, for having me on. I'm so excited.
I'm delighted that you're here, and I'm so excited that you're excited. So tell our audience about What She Found.
So What She Found, it explores trauma and dissociation through the lens of Lewis Carroll's Through the Looking Glass. It's not a direct adaptation. That was definitely not a goal with it. In case you're not familiar with what dissociation is, I know it's a bit of a loaded term.
I'm not, no.
Okay, well, I've got a definition.
You're the best. Go for it.
So dissociation is a cluster of disorders. They affect the memory, identity, emotion, perception, behavior, and sense of self. Some symptoms may be feeling detached. You may feel outside of your body, loss of memory, and it usually occurs due to various traumas.
And you've taken that very complex, I guess it's diagnosis,
yes.
And you've applied it to the character of Alice mm-hmm. and Through the Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm. I have.
Wow. What gave you that idea?
So, like an abundance of my ideas, it happened during a psychiatry session. And I wasn't doing really well in 2016. And I was trying to figure out what was going on with me. And so I was trying to put this word, I was trying to give it some type of life. I identify things with color, with sound. I'm very sensory. And I started to think about bright lights, mirrors, and through the looking glass. And the moment that Alice steps through the mirror and she turns around, she looks at the room she's in. Now, it looks almost exactly like the room she was just in, but everything is just slightly off. Things are kind of skewed, maybe more to the left. Things are blurred. The writing is backwards. And that's the best way that I've been able to explain what dissociation is.
Wow. It's been a while since I've read the Alice in Wonderland books, and I love Alice in Wonderland. I think she's a terrific character.
Yes.
She's so mouthy, and she's like a total smart mouth, and I love that about her. Remind me, is that what happened in Through the Looking Glass? Were things just skewed, or is this just an overall feeling of how we interpret her world?
Through the Looking Glass, she does reference that. I forget the chapter, but it was a few times that she did reference that things just weren't right. That things, like, they were just slightly off. And I think that's definitely a theme through The Looking Glass and Alice in Wonderland.
Yeah.
That things are, you know, definitely slightly a little off. But there was something about Through the Looking Glass and the mirrors that really reminded me of this feeling that I was trying to figure out how the hell to explain to people.
So you were feeling that way.
I was.
And so you channeled that into writing.
Yes.
And writing this piece. How did it feel once you started writing? Did it start making sense and falling into place a little bit, or did it get muddier?
Both. A lot of the poetry, it's mostly poetry. There's nothing really linear about this in ways. There is a trajectory of the story, you know, that I worked hard to make sure that was there. But I've never written anything like this before. I do write a lot of poetry. And one of my professors, she challenged me and said, you know, the next show you write, you're going to write under me. And you're going to write in all poetry. And I was like, okay, Helen, if you say so.
Wow.
And so I did it. A lot of the poetry was written in a lot of really bad moments of mine. I was manic for a while. And so I went back and looked at all that poetry and writing and saw similar common themes and words and sensory type deals that were popping up. And so I started to craft this script based around those things and kind of implement, you know, other dialogue, other ideas, things like that. And that's how I created this script.
Was the original poetry, was it just more therapeutic for you as you were going through the difficult time, and then all of a sudden you went back and you're like, wow, there's something there.
Yeah, that's what I was doing, because I was trying to figure out, like, you know, I was trying to figure out, you know, if there, what was triggering me, the senses, sounds, like, if there was just some theme that I could help myself with, that I could document to figure out, to just help myself a little more. And so then I came back and I saw all this stuff and the themes, and I was like, oh, okay, let's make art out of our pain.
Why not?
Yeah.
Yeah, and it feels like, from what I'm getting to you, from you in our conversation, is that maybe some time had passed, so you had a little bit of objectivity so that you could take that and not make it so personal and then work it into a narrative.
That was definitely the biggest challenge with this. I did do a show here in 2016. It's called Garbage. It went through a lot of... it was very personal. It was based on a lot of childhood trauma and trauma into my early 20s that I had dealt with, and how I was coming to terms with it. Went to Port Fringe Theater Festival in Portland, Maine with it. It went really well. But my director, who is also the director of What She Found, NJ Aguna, and my tech director, Connor Daniel Bartram, sat down with me and said, you know, Megan, you make really great art. We're on board with it. You have to remove yourself as the performer. And I was like, how dare you? Yeah. You know, like, it's my baby. And
it's hard to do that, is. Right? Yeah.
And so this summer we were at Governor's Island in a residency with Rising Sun Performance Company. And I had put myself into this. So there were three of us. So I was acting in it. I was the lead role, Fiona. And after the second day of performing, it was the first show of the day. And I was just down and out, just on the floor. And my director, NJ, she just came up to me and she said, you can't do this anymore. And I said, I can't. You're right. I can't do it anymore. And that's that. And so, you know, it was really understanding my limits, understanding what I can and cannot do. I don't have the memory retention anymore.
For the dialogue,
anything like that. Yeah. I can't retain it. Emotionally, it's just, it's a lot, and it's kind of, now I look back, it's kind of torturing myself, which I'm really good at doing because I'm a writer. But it's picking and choosing the ways.
High five to that, right? I hear ya.
Picking the ways to choose, you know, to torture yourself, so.
Oh, sure. Well, plus, you know, a different actor who didn't live through all of it, because that would be essentially you living through that.
Yeah.
Performance after performance. Mm-hmm. But a different actor would figure out a, I don't want to say more clinical way, but a more, a safer way.
Yes.
Of being able to step in and step out again. Because it's not them.
Yes.
So, it's it was a brave thing that you did, and I know that a lot of actors would definitely would want to do that. It's they, you know, actors want to act, and and you, you know, but then again, I'm sure you could write something else in the future that you can act in when you feel a little more comfortable with it.
Yeah, I think so. But for right now, I'm definitely okay with taking the back seat and just working on really writing, walking away from the thing, and producing. So yeah,
cool. How are rehearsals going?
They're great. I've only been to two. Talk about walking away from the work.
Yeah.
So I went to the read-through. That was good. It was nice to hear the language out loud and then instead of inside my head.
Sure.
And I went to rehearsal last week, and I was absolutely humbled by the care that, you know, they were really... I don't want to say they're cradling my work, but they're taking a certain amount of care with it while also being extremely destructive, which it is a bit of a destructive script. It's not nice. It's not a fun story. It's not pleasant. It's challenging. I believe that theater should be challenging.
Sure.
So they're doing a really great job. They're rehearsing right now. I think they're putting in some tech elements tonight. They're rehearsing at Columbia University, so I'm heading up there after this to see what's going on.
Is it really real? Because I know, like, I just did a musical, and one of the hardest things that I could do, because I wrote a book, and then I have a co-writer who was a composer, and one of the hardest things that I could do was sit in the rehearsal room and not say anything. I had to be so disciplined. There were so many times when I was like, no, that's wrong, and change this, and I want that, and you just have to trust.
Yes, you just have to trust it. And you know, I'm privileged to know my director very well. We're very good friends, so I have an idea of what's gonna happen, but sometimes she just throws me, and at first I'm kind of just like sitting there twitching silently, and I'm just like, you just have to watch it and stay silent, because you know what, Megan, maybe you're actually gonna like this. And I'd say that 9 out of 10 times I don't give her a hard time about it. But definitely sitting there when you have a preconceived idea of what it should be and not saying anything is difficult.
Particularly also because I would assume that the actor who was playing the role you were playing knows that you played the role before.
Yes.
Okay, so it must be... I don't want to say that would be weird, but do you feel... like you don't want to influence her performance, or does it make you feel weird to be in the rehearsal room with her? Or
it doesn't, because she's actually also a very good friend of mine, and she was the first person I thought of for this, because she's writing the musical Ingenue train right now, as you know, young women do sometimes in their 20s.
Sure, yeah.
And she's fabulous. She is. But I know she was just itching for something a little grittier.
Oh, yeah.
And so I was like, you know what? I'll talk to her about it. And Jay and I agreed, you know, Helena would be perfect for this. And she was really floored and just like, I can't believe you thought of me. And I was like, yes.
Sure.
You know, you want that grit. You're willing to go there. And I want to give you the chance to explore that side of you as an actor, to perform that side of you as a person, decide maybe you don't want to do it again, maybe you want to do it again. And she's doing an amazing job, and I can't be happier with the work she's done.
What's her name?
Helena Fari.
Okay. And what's your director's name?
My director is NJ Aguna.
Okay. All right. You talked about him, so I thought, let's give him a shout-out. Why not?
Absolutely. They're wonderful.
That's such a great gift. I'm sure there were times when she was probably like, okay, it's great to play the ingenue, but I would like to do, I don't know, just something really... down and dirty.
Yeah.
You know, like True Love or Extremity or something like that where I'm not, you know, singing in a pretty dress.
Mm-hmm.
I want to play something gritty.
Yeah.
And so good for you that you did that and that you saw that in her.
Mm-hmm.
That you had the intuition of knowing her as an actor, and she's killing it.
Yeah, she absolutely is. They all are. We have Brendan Gregory and Jacobella Luongo, who are also cast as A and B. They're playing various roles within, and they're also doing a really stellar job. You know, there's some lifts, there's some movement in the show too, which I didn't know was going to happen, but that's totally cool. It looks
awesome.
Great.
Right.
And they're doing a really great job supporting Helena, and Helena is doing a really great job supporting them. I'm really pleased with the work they're all doing.
That's great. I've always, and I heard this described to me by a stage manager. She said, you know, you're the writer, and you go, and you have the base vision. Mm-hmm. You really do. And then the next level is the director, and it's the director's job to start pulling things out of that you never saw.
Yes.
And then developing those and really getting micro with all of that.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's the actor's job to even expound upon that. And if you are there when you're needed and you get out of the way the rest of the time, mm-hmm. and trust, they're going to be amazing.
I definitely believe that, because that's what has happened with this. And, you know, it's great. You know, you can't be on top of them. You have to let them create. You have to let them explore. And that is something that I've always believed in, and putting into practice finally has been a test.
Right. Yeah.
But I can't recommend it to... I cannot not recommend it to other writers.
Sure.
Like, you have to walk away. It's healthy. Be healthy. Be healthy. We're, like, not healthy a lot of the time in New York City. We drink too much coffee. Just be healthy.
Yeah, absolutely. Work on something else.
Mm-hmm.
Start a new project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think writers are, you know, they're responsible for almost the future.
Yeah.
You know, you're working on stuff that you know isn't going to see the light of day, usually, unless, you know, you have a high-level film and TV job,
mm-hmm.
even if it's a movie,
mm-hmm.
for a year or so.
Yeah.
So go and do that.
Mm-hmm.
I always say
work.
I always try to have another project at hand, just in case things aren't going the way I want this project to go. I can work on that project. So
yep.
It's helpful.
Yep.
That's healthy, right?
I think so.
That's being healthy,
yes.
I think. Cool. So, tell us about your experience with Frigid Fest.
Oh my goodness. So, Frigid Festival. I actually was the marketing director for 3 years.
Were you?
I was.
Oh my gosh.
And Helena was actually the festival coordinator for 3 years. So, that's how we know each other, because we ran this festival.
This I did not know. Wow,
yes.
I'm sitting here with Festival Royalty. Okay.
So, yeah, I have a really long history. I've been involved with Horse Trade since 2011. I was a literary intern, and you know, you come in and out, and then I wound up here, and now I'm here, you know, as a participant, which is super cool. I love this place. I love the Frigid Festival.
First year as a participant?
It is.
Oh, wow.
It is.
Neat.
It's so weird, but,
yeah.
You know, it's still great to know that I'm still going to be at one of my favorite venues in the city, surrounded by some of the best people I know, some artists that in the festival that I definitely know, and some new ones that I don't. And so I'm just really excited to see this melding of artistic creativity together.
Right. And you've seen how people can really form
mm-hmm.
long,
yes.
lasting friendships and relationships and start working together,
mm-hmm.
just by coming together with the festivals and supporting each other.
Yeah.
That's really cool to watch.
I mean, also, our tech director, Connor Daniel Bartram, he was actually a tech a few years ago, and he's one of the house bartenders at the Crane. So
nice.
It has three people that have worked on Frigid previously, and I actually met my director, NJ, in the booth at the Crane, sitting there during a show, and she had turned to me and she said, "So, you said you're a playwright?" And I was like, "Yes." She's like, "When are you gonna send me your stuff?" And she hounded me for 6 months, and finally I sent her something. She's like, "Okay, so I want to work with you." And this was in 2013-2014, and here we are. Yeah.
That's amazing.
It's really great.
Now, when you stop and you think about it,
mm-hmm.
like when you just pause and you just stay in the moment, how do you feel?
About everything in the festival and what I'm doing in general?
Yeah, just how does it feel to be a participant and to be an artist in the festival?
It feels... like something that I didn't think I could ever do. I never thought... that my work, people would like it. I never thought that I would have the support I did this time last year. I mean, I was in a hospital. I wasn't doing very well. So to take all those things together and think that I'm right here in this moment pausing to think about this is absolutely phenomenal, and I'm so happy to be here.
Wow. That's great.
Yeah.
Please remember that. Please let that stay with you. This is, I would think this would be a really charmed time in your life.
It kind of feels like that. Yeah, and in certain ways it does. I mean, things are hard, you know? It's cool, but to be able to put up my work, that's, you know, that's freaking something. And it's something to be really proud about.
You have a show in New York City.
I do.
There are people all over the world who wish they had a show in New York City.
Yeah.
And I think we all have to remind ourselves of that sometimes.
Yes.
You know, that's why I say, so I always say, you know, like when I'm in the middle of a situation like this, I'm like, just stay in the moment and stay present and realize that this is all happening and it's so wonderful.
Yeah.
So, and I have a feeling it's going to happen to you a lot more. You seem like a very, very talented young lady.
Thank you.
I'm going to do my absolute best to come see your show.
We would love to see you.
Oh, I will try. I promise I will try.
I know.
I will try.
I know. It's busy. It's crazy.
It is.
It's insane.
I know. I'm over 28 shows. I'm doing 28 interviews. It's wild. So now, before we wrap up, can you please give our audience your social media information for the show where they can go buy tickets and learn more about
it? Yeah, sure. So you can go to facebook.com/whatshefound. That's going to be all one word. We have links to our Facebook event. You can find tickets at horsetrade.info. I also do want to mention that 20% of our box office is going to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline, which also shares funding with Veterans Crisis Line.
Awesome.
We all decided that it would definitely be best to donate some of that box office. That's really important to me. It's important to the staff, to the cast. So definitely come out and support, because you're also helping two really, really important organizations as well.
Props to you for that. That's great. That's like money where your mouth is, right? Money, that's putting your money where your mouth is.
Absolutely.
That's great. It's been delightful talking to
you. Thank you so much for having me on, Sean. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good, good. I'm glad you had a great time. So thank you for being with us, Megan Bendelt from What She Found. Folks, please welcome to the show Jack Spagnola and Noam Shapiro from the show Little League. Hi, Jack and Noam, and welcome to your program, Is Your Ticket.
Thank you so much for having us.
It's so good to be here. Thanks.
It's my pleasure. So tell our audience about the play. It's a play, right?
Yeah.
The play, Little League.
Yeah, so Little League is a four-character comedy. It's about two young moms who are realizing that they don't have all the answers to their kids' parenting questions, and two teens who've been together for a long time and are realizing that they've actually outgrown each other and outgrown the community that they both lived in.
Wow, and then are the two teens, are they friends? Are they a couple?
Yeah, they're a couple, and they've been dating pretty much their whole childhood, and now it is the summer before they go off to college, and this is kind of their last hurrah together.
And the two moms are best friends. They were both pregnant together and have raised their children together, and all the action happens on the sidelines of Little League baseball games over the course of a couple of days in the summer.
What a great concept.
Yeah, we're excited about it.
And how did you come up with that sort of framework of a show?
Yeah, so my day job is I'm a pre-K teacher, so I spend a ton of time with children and the dynamic between a child and their parents and kind of all that comes with that. And I think that that's kind of where the seed of this play started. It kind of started with thinking about what do you do when your child asks you big questions about death or love or God or something like that? And it kind of, how as a parent, how do you react to that? Are there right ways to react? Are there wrong ways to react? Or how do you stay afloat during those moments? So that was kind of the seed for it.
And it also came out of Jack played Little League for many, many years and has been interested in exploring a world of parents and children for a long time and thought that this would be the perfect setting to explore that history for yourself as a playwright and also just this environment for a play.
Wow.
Yeah.
Tell me about the characters.
Totally. So the two teens are Sam and Daria. Sam is a kind of a pot-smoking teen who's a little apathetic about his life right now. He's kind of going through the motions. He's not concerned with his future as much as maybe some other 18-year-olds might be. He got into college. He's going to NYU. He's excited about that, but also is feeling a little more afraid of leaving home than I think that he leads on to believe, than he shows. And Daria.
Daria is, so they've been together for a long time, and Daria is excited to get away from her home. She wants to reinvent herself when she goes to college, and she's really excited about kind of how she can shape her personality on her social media presence.
I love that.
She's figuring out how to take the best Insta shots, how to build the best kind of online Facebook profile, and she's trying to follow people to figure out how she can be the coolest, newest, funnest person on her college campus. And she, unlike Sam, is going far away. She's going across the country to California, and is excited to kind of imagine what beach Daria is like compared to suburban Daria.
What about the moms?
And the moms are Marcia and Phoebe. Phoebe is she is so into Little League and so excited about Little League. However, her son is the worst player probably in the whole town.
Wow.
But
in the history of the town, he runs, you know, instead of running to first base, he will run directly into the outfield at one point during the play. And
he'll turn to face her when he's on the bat.
Right. Like, to wave instead of, you know, necessarily concentrating on, you know, making contact with the ball, which doesn't really happen much anyway. And she is a mommy blogger who is obsessed with internet and trying to, you know, craft this kind of happiness online to kind of fill this void that might be in her own life, that is not there. And it comes out, you know, in the show kind of where that anxiety is coming from and everything like that.
Yeah, and whereas Phoebe seems externally put together, Marcia's a total mess. and she's a loving mom, but it's a lot for her to handle, and she wasn't expecting everything that would come with being a mom. She knows nothing about baseball, knows nothing about sports, but is trying really hard to pretend like she does. And her daughter, Susie, is actually the best player on the team. She hits home runs every single game, and she's only 6 years old. And so it's this kind of this really fun relationship between these two moms who can relate but are also competitive with each other.
Wow.
Yeah.
And how, what's the time span of the play?
It's about over a couple of days. So it goes from like
a Wednesday
through the weekend. So we see them, you know, sometimes there are back-to-back games where the moms are, you know, would do anything but to be, would rather be anywhere else than a metal bleacher where their backs are getting destroyed and they've just been watching their children play for what seems like hours and hours over a weekend, and they've done nothing else, and all they want to do is, you know, go get brunch or something like that. So it goes over a few days.
Now, are they discussing the past of these this couple that has known each other their whole life and been together for as long as they could be a couple?
Yeah.
Do they go back and, I mean, is that how we find out about all that?
So the scenes are kind of intercut. You've got six scenes over the course of the play, and the characters all mix together just by chance. And so through these scenes, we find out the history of the parents' relationships, these two moms, and the history of this couple. We find out in the first scene that they have, the young teen couple is basically just almost broken up. They can't take that last step. They keep on trying to get there, and every time it's too scary for them.
And what really needs to be is space between them needs to, you know, be the final straw to really break them up, because before that, you know, in the suburban town, they'll see each other everywhere. So they're very their lives are very interconnected, and
each by chance meets one of the two moms,
right?
And this interaction with someone who is totally different and totally new is almost like a confessional booth for them, and conversely for the moms as well.
Right.
And they're able to relate to someone who's in a totally different position than they are, but be more honest than they could be with one of their contemporaries, with Sam or with Daria or with Marcia and Phoebe.
Right.
Is there a special association with the game of baseball worked into the concept and the framework of the show? Because you said you played Little League your whole life.
Whole life. I mean, I think it's this thing that, you know, baseball is something that, and Little League especially, it's like, even if you're not athletic, like, your parents kind of make you play, or you try to play, all your friends are doing it. So these children that were, you know, watching people watch are kind of at that age of, you know, everyone's going to get thrown in and everyone's going to give it a go. Right. So I think it's this interesting moment of this kind of first, second grade age where everyone's trying to be athletic. You don't know who is and who isn't yet.
Right.
And like, kids aren't, you know, mean about it necessarily, but you can tell who's going to like play in high school. Even the parents can tell, I guess, even if the children don't know it yet, you know, like, because some are awful and some are amazing.
Yeah. One of my favorite lines, Daria, whose younger brother is a player on the team, she says to Sam, all he does is strike out. It's so sad, it's depressing. And this idea of kind of, you know, swinging and missing with mm-hmm. all of these characters. They're just trying to make some contact, and they keep on just hitting air. And it's how do you finally make that contact, which I think is a nice kind of metaphor that runs through the play
Right, and in like, you know, I grew up in the suburbs of New York City, and I think it was just, Little League was this thing that everyone did. You tried it, you saw what it, you know, you saw if it worked or not. You like gave it a go. And it didn't work for a lot of people, but it was almost like this thing that parents felt they like needed their kid to try.
And how did you feel about it?
I mean, I was, you know, I think that it's been fun exploring this play because I really enjoyed it.
Oh,
you know,
good.
I loved Little League. I like had a great time. I played like every summer and in the spring, and it was awesome. And it was, you know, it was a great time for me, but I think looking back, what I remember more than anything else in a way is like the children who like weren't that good, like the kids who would run the opposite way.
Really?
I don't know why. I know. So I was like, I have to write this play and talk about, you know, all of the kids that we kind of forget about that maybe it didn't come so easy for them, but they were kind of forced to do this thing that they didn't necessarily want to do.
Which was my story.
Right.
You know, my parents did not get the hint. We started off with swimming, and I was too cold, and I was too scared by all the other swimmers. And then they signed me up for Little League Baseball, and I couldn't swing the bat at all. I swung it once, and the bat went flying into the outfield. Then they signed me up for soccer, and I was so much more interested in running away from the players than actually running to try and score a goal, and we ended up getting benched, my friend and I, and we would just sit out in the rain and cheer, and then they would let us go for a minute and a half, and we'd run out screaming, and so I tried that for a couple of years, and it was a pretty miserable experience, fun at the time, because we didn't know anything, but I can only imagine my parents just kind of freaking out on the sidelines as I basically ran on to the other soccer field instead of chasing the ball. So
that would so be that,
yeah. Yeah.
That's I'm in your camp. No,
yeah.
for sure. It's really cool, and I'm still kind of like stuck on the whole idea that the most noticeable kids were the ones who weren't doing well.
Yeah,
and I'm. Is that explored in depth in the show?
Definitely is.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's really, you know, like I said, yeah, you hear about a child, you know, kind of running, you know, into the outfield. You hear about children striking out often. And I think for me, like a theme of this play kind of overall is just like the idea that we're all just trying our best. You know, and that's kind of like what life is in a lot of ways. We all try our very best, and that's kind of what we put forward. You know, you're going to mess up, and you're going to, you know, be bad at a lot of stuff. But this idea of if we all admitted that we weren't good at something rather than trying to pretend or trying to, you know, or being, if we lived in a kind of a society that was okay with saying you don't know, you didn't have to kind of mask that
you don't
you
have
know
to be perfect.
Yeah, everything. You don't have to be perfect because we're all just trying our best and none of us are perfect. So I think that's kind of, you know, why I was so interested in exploring these children who maybe, you know, we do have Susie who is the phenom that the Little League player who hits home runs, but you hear about so many of these other children who aren't very good, but that's okay.
It sounds like there are themes, and again, I'm guessing here, about allowing people to find themselves.
Absolutely.
As opposed to defining them for themselves.
Absolutely.
And I know that that's... I hear that a lot with people who struggle with their kids. It's like I have to let go. It's so difficult to let go, and I love that you're writing about that.
Totally, yeah. And I think it's like every child is going to be on their own track. And you know, how do you know when a parent, like, when do you stop signing them up for all these classes? When do you kind of just let them explore the world in their own way on their own time? But at the same time, you want to be a parent who encourages all of these things. So it's this very, it's very complicated thing.
Phoebe says, you know, I wish that kids came with a book with all of their interests. That would make things so much easier.
Great line.
You know, and
great line.
Similarly, kind of Sam and Daria both want to say so much, but they don't have the right words for it. And all that comes out is, you know, I just am saying words because their feelings are larger than their ability to express themselves.
Right.
And that's, you know, something that I think everyone can relate to.
Yeah.
Well, plus you're writing from the point of view of high school students who have it fully developed into adults.
Totally.
So that's, I think that rings very true.
Yeah.
That's great. How are rehearsals going?
Amazing.
Really
fun.
We've got
a really, really talented cast.
Yeah.
Of four great actors. Mm-hmm. And each of them is bringing so much new insight into the characters and particularly humor. This
good.
Is a really funny play.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of playfulness in the room.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. Excellent.
And I think the one of the most exciting things for me right now is that with each rehearsal and as we get closer to our opening, I think it's exciting how it's feeling less and less just my piece. I mean, I think Noam has his fingerprints all over it. There's, you know, our wonderful team of actors who are putting their own spin on it. We're finding new things in rehearsal. I'm rewriting throughout the process. And it's just been a really beautiful process so far.
Yeah, and it's a great mix of kind of actors who bring a certain maturity and experience to the roles. We have Barry Kialoha, who's playing Phoebe, and Kia Trivet, who's playing Marsha, and they've both acted in a variety of capacities over a number of years and have that kind of sense of perspective, which I think grounds the piece, but also adds a mature level of comedy.
Right.
And then Bartley Booze and Leslie Class, who are both younger actors and have that kind of youthfulness and spontaneity,
right?
Yeah.
Which rings true,
right?
Wow,
absolutely
excellent. How has your experience been with Frigid Fest?
It's been great. I mean, I think it's, you know, just having being giving a venue for more than, you know, one or two shows in New York City has been incredible, and I think, you know, having their support between tech and publicity has been so wonderful for my, you know, young playwriting career moving forward, and having them as, you know, a force really in the New York theater scene.
And it you know, it bears mentioning that it's kind of a homecoming for me and Jack,
right?
And our producer Lizianna Lincoln, who runs a program called Paper Crane at the Crane. It's a monthly kind of variety night, particularly of comedic work.
Yeah.
And Jack, Lizzie, and I first collaborated on a piece at Paper Crane about a year ago, and so it's very exciting to kind of bring the essence of that piece back to the stage.
Yeah. Where we all met. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, is this the first performance or iteration of Little League. Has it not been on a stage before?
Not workshopped. This is our first experience with it that we're sharing with everybody else, which is cool. Yeah. Really cool.
Are you nervous?
I think more excited.
Yeah.
I think we feel like we've done as much as we can do, and I think the next thing we need to bring in is an audience to see it.
Right.
You know, absolutely, to see what we got. You know, you don't know until, yeah.
And something that a number of different audiences for Jack's mm-hmm. plays have noted is that none of the plays' kind of geographies are specified, mm-hmm. and everyone gets a sense that the play takes place in their hometown. And that's something that we're really excited to kind of, to bring an audience in and to ask them, like, where do you think this is? And if they say it's, you know, in Westchester or the suburbs of Chicago,
right,
or if it's in Los Angeles or if it's in Houston, seeing that kind of response.
Yeah.
Because I think the essence of the play kind of hopefully transcends, mm-hmm. Regardless of where you've grown up, those experiences are universal.
Right.
That's terrific.
Exactly.
So with your plays, you've just put it out there to people. Where do you think this takes place? And you've gotten all over the map?
All over the map. I mean, the first reading of this, you know, we were just in my living room and we were talking about, you know, where does this take place? And everybody kind of said, you know, we have one of our actors from Salt Lake City. And he was like, you know, he described the baseball field that he grew up, you know, driving by and everything like that. And Lizzieanna Lincoln, our producer, is from outside of Austin. She was like, you know, this is where I grew up. And, you know, just hearing those voices and opinions is so exciting to me. So, you know, on the script where it's a setting, it just says a Little League baseball field. You know, we don't specify where it is because we're hoping that everyone will identify with it as, you know, where they grew up.
I think that's terrific because so many plays and TV shows are set in just the big cities.
Right.
New York, LA, Chicago, or Miami, or and to be able to be nondescript about it, mm-hmm. I think allows folks to put their own imprint onto it and in a way take ownership.
Totally.
And that's great. That's a very giving way of writing. So I think that's awesome.
Thanks, yeah.
Now before we go, can you please give our audience your social media information for the show?
Yeah. So on Facebook you can find us at Little League, a new play by Jack Spagnola. Mm-hmm. And there you can find information about the show, show times, and a link to buy tickets. Mm-hmm. And then you can also find us on our Instagram account, Little League Play. So that's at Little League Play, and similarly on Twitter as well.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah.
Well, gentlemen, this has been a delight, and I wish you broken legs, but not broken arms, because I'm sure people have to swing bats.
Exactly.
Even if they're imaginary bats, right. Who knows? you still need your arms. It sounds like a really terrific show with great universal themes, and I'm going to do my absolute very best to come see it.
Thank you so much.
We're so excited. So much fun talking about this play with you.
It's been my pleasure. So thank you for being with us, Jack Spagnola and Noam Shapiro from Little League. Weren't they amazing? Great interviews, and I just know you're going to enjoy their shows. So go see them. You can find information and tickets to all of the 2018 Frigid Festival shows at www.horsetrade.info. Once again, I'd like to thank my guests, Ilse Jewell from I Lied to Marianne Williamson, A Totally True Story, Megan Bendelt from What She Found, and Jack Spagnola and Noam Shapiro from Little League. You can find more episodes of Your Program Is Your Ticket at facebook.com/YourProgramIsYourTicket. I'm on Twitter at @ProgramTicket. The website is YourProgramIsYourTicket.com. I'm also on YouTube. Search me out at Your Program Is Your Ticket. And I'm on iTunes and SoundCloud. Rate me, write me a review, subscribe. All that stuff helps my profile. It's great. Folks, take a little time to see a show this week, and don't forget to give a smaller show some love. There's lots of great theater gems out there. Until our next show, good night, theater people, and curtain.